hello, everyone. Welcome back to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. I'm your host, Michelle Zeman. Be sure to take a listen for those two code words so that way you can get your free CEUs for the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. I am so excited to introduce my guest for this evening. She comes to us from Autism Jumpstart. Her name is Carrie Woodward. Welcome to the podcast, Carrie.
Thanks, Michelle. I'm so glad to be here and I'm so excited to chat with you.
Me too. I am so happy that we got a chance to connect. I'm so excited to go into our topic tonight. But first, I would love to know, and I would love for our listeners to know, how did you get into ABA?
Okay, so it was the very first job I ever had in college. When I first started college, I wasn't working. I was just studying and I was a psychology major. And I had a girlfriend who was also a psychology major. And randomly she was like, hey, are you looking for a job? And I was like, oh, yeah, actually, that my parents have been breathing down my neck about that. And so she was working for a psychologist who had just gotten her PhD out of UC San Diego. And I don't even know if she was board certified at the time, but she now is a BCBA. And she is starting an organization where we were working one-on-one with kids with autism. And it was 22 years ago. So it was like a different model. But I just fell in love with it immediately. I had always loved kids. And so the idea that I could go to work and like play and be silly and goofy was like, already a win for me. And then to be able to actually see these principles that I was learning and implementing actually make significant change for these children and their families, I was like in love with it immediately. And so I've not ever worked or done anything other than ABA in my life.
That is so amazing. I mean, it's so amazing to work at a job where you can basically be a kid again. Like that is my favorite part about being a BCBA, quite frankly.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I've always just loved the opportunity to feel inspired about going to work every day. And yeah. I truly have always had that. I've been really, really fortunate to always have that in every different agency that I worked at and every different role that I've had, and like from, one-on-one therapist all the way up to clinical director, I have always really felt very inspired to show up at work every day.
That is amazing. And now you have your own company, Autism Jumpstart. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So I actually worked at an agency, my last like role at an agency, and I was there for 17 years and I loved them. They were like family. I loved the kids that we worked with. But it was also very demanding. And I had two babies in the course of 2 years, all right around the beginning of the pandemic. So I had an 8-week-old and an under 2-year-old when the pandemic started. Wow. And I was on maternity leave. And so when I went back to work, I just sort of was hit in the face pretty immediately about how unmanageable it was to be able to maintain that level of work. Yeah. And what I needed to do to spend time with my kids and my family. And it was one of the hardest decisions I've ever made. But I think that like life happens for reasons, that we don't really know at the time. And I know that I was meant to leave because I know that I was meant to start Autism Jumpstart. And I didn't know what I was going to do when I left. I sort of meandered around. I was like floating around without an oar in a boat. And I had a very good friend who called me and she was like concerned about her son's development. Wasn't talking yet. And just like, she was like, you're the autism person. So I want to come to you. And I didn't really know where to begin to help her. It was so weird. I had been on the service end of things once kids had a diagnosis and had like gotten enrolled in ABA, but I hadn't really been on this side yet. And so as I was like helping her navigate this process, yeah, I was just floored by the gap in our continuum of care. Like where, when parents are concerned about their kids in the beginning stages, there's just not a lot out there. And then even when they do get started, everything is a wait list. Everything takes time. Everything is delay, delay, delay. And one of the places that I referred her to look for resources, she called and they couldn't offer her anything because there was an 8-month wait list for their ABA program. But they offered her this like 1-week intensive that was $25,000 and it wasn't covered by insurance. And it like literally she sent that to me and I just had the light bulb that went off and I was like, okay, here's where I need to be because there's so much that parents can learn and need to learn and should be available to them. And for some reason, it's just not there yet. And so that's why I dove in and started Autism Jumpstart.
Wow. You know, our listeners can't really like see us necessarily, but when you were saying $25,000, I'm sitting here and I'm shaking my head because that's like, oh my gosh, such corporate greed right there.
I know. And, you know, I understand all angles, you know, like as a behavior analyst, you look at the controlling variables. And so you understand, like, if they have a super high demand, they have a price that I guess. But I was recently listening to a podcast about autism and just the data and the statistics about kids who have come from lower income families and how they get their diagnosis later in life because they don't have parents that have the ability and the resources and that maybe the education or the wherewithal to like pursue and push and advocate and fight. And so like there is a huge disparity amongst children who come from wealthier families or live in areas that are wealthy in resources and kids who just are not. And I don't, you call it fair or unfair, obviously it is what it is, but my goal is to try and I'm not going to say I can eliminate it completely, but I just think that education and resources should be available for anybody, regardless of where they live, how much money their parents make, you know, what languages they speak, et cetera. So
I agree. I couldn't even agree more. I mean, you know, it's so interesting because when you work with a variety of families, you know, you work with some families who happen to be in a higher socioeconomic status and, you know, they might be able to access these things. I was fortunate enough at a young age where I was able to get a diagnosis because of our status. But unfortunately, not everyone gets that same privilege. You mentioned wait lists. Oh my gosh, just calling companies alone over the past week and a half, 8 months to a year to get their child in care.
And that's where it's in the United States where resources are the most plentiful. Let's not even talk about internationally around the world. I have people that reach out from Pakistan. I just met with a mom this morning from England. Their resources, they have nothing. They have 5-year wait lists just to get a diagnosis, even though a parent knows that there's a problem, can recognize that there's a delay that needs to be addressed. They can't even get an assessment conducted for a diagnosis until 5 years, 6 years down the line, or there's nothing at all. You know, I have a mom from Pakistan who I've engaged with, and there's nothing there. They hardly even recognize it as a disability that they don't talk about it. It's like a taboo subject. And so she's just out there trying to learn as much as she can to support her kids. So, you know, I'm a mom. I think becoming a mother changed my perspective. It gave me a new level of empathy for parents who are navigating, and going through this with their kids. Yeah. And I don't think any parent should have to struggle and worry about being able to provide their child with the best possible chance of success in their life because they don't have the resources or the money or what, you know, all of the different things that they need.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, you mentioned a 5-year waiting list just to get a diagnosis. I mean, that's baffling to even hear that, you know.
I know.
But you have this course, Jumpstart the Journey. So tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Okay. So I have always loved working with parents and I've always loved teaching. I taught a course at one point at a grad level course. I just really enjoy sharing about behavior analysis. And then I also did a lot of research and study in the last couple of years about early intervention strategies, but also like a shift in the way that we do early intervention that is a lot more centered on play and a lot more focused on, instead of trying to teach all of these individual skills, really focusing on helping to solidify social motivation for kids. So, because that's where learning's happening. That's where childhood learning happens, is by looking up and watching people and imitating and being interested and aware of what's going on around them. And so for our young autistic kids who are just not tuned in to their social environment and don't have that innate social motivation, they're missing out on learning. And that's sort of where the delays begin. So all of this early reinforcer conditioning, essentially, or trying to build value in social things so that kids are more interested in their social environment, it can all be done through play and really kind of natural, easy ways if parents just learn how to do it. And so I was like, okay, so if the wait lists are forever, and we do now know how much the brain plasticity plays into why early intervention is so successful. Essentially, the brain in these early stages of life it's just a lot more open to change and learning, and things are happening more quickly. And so that's why EI is seen as so beneficial for kids. But when we think about all of the delays that come in this process and the journey, kids might not even get enrolled into treatment until well beyond that like window where it's prime for learning. So that's where I was like, okay, I can create something to teach parents. I can just basically provide them the education and the tools to be able to sit down and play with their kids in ways that is going to bring them more in tune to people and get them more interested in watching people. And then also start working on some of this early communication stuff for our kids who are not yet beginning the stage of language development. Wow. And so that's what I created.
That's amazing. And, you know, it makes me feel so much more hopeful for the families that, you know, are kind of like struggling, especially, you know, parents who want their children to be able to get diagnosed and be able to access services when there is such a long wait list, when right. there is, you know, when there's so much going on that prevents their child. I mean, the fact that there are courses like this and there are things like this that exist, I mean, that really just is very remarkable. So I appreciate what you do for sure.
I'm hopeful that it's making a difference and that it continues to make a difference. Like, I think that a lot of parents that I've engaged with tell me that they recognize delays really early on for their kids. Some parents who are really like, maybe they had an older sibling that already had a diagnosis, so parents are a lot more aware and are sort of watching for, but they'll tell me that they were seeing signs at like 6 months or 8 months, and everybody, doctors, family, everybody is like, relax. It's not that big of a deal. It's just like, it'll take time. Give it time. Give it time. And even my friend who was going through this with her son, even her pediatrician was like, at 18 months, if he's still not talking, then I'm going to refer you. And so it's like, wait a second. We're in this window of time where we know that our kids are so available and ready for learning. And yet we're saying for some reason, don't, no, 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 not yet, not yet, not yet, until they can actually get the ball rolling. And so my goal is that for parents, even before they get a diagnosis, maybe if they know that their kids are experiencing delays, can start to work on sort of stimulating this, like this learning process for their child. And the research is showing us that on all like the baby sibling studies, so they're doing a lot of autism research on younger siblings of kids who already have a diagnosis, because we know that statistically there's an increased probability that these siblings might receive a diagnosis. So they do all this research and then they follow these kids sort of longitudinally and see whether or not they go on to receive a diagnosis. So then they can look back at the data and say, okay, this child did end up receiving a diagnosis. What are his data looking like in when he was an infant? They're doing some early intervention, intensive behavioral intervention for these younger siblings. Yeah. And like the results are really remarkable. Like 14 of the 15 participants in this research that I was reading the other day went on to have typical development, even though they were displaying signs of autism between 6 and 8 months old. And so like, we obviously, funding is not there to provide this intensive early intervention for kids who don't have a diagnosis yet. And I understand that, but I also feel like give parents the tools and let them make the informed decision on what they want to be doing with their kids at this early stage. And then later, when they do have that diagnosis and can get the funding and get enrolled in programs, then get them enrolled in a program. Like I don't ever want to be seen as trying to be a replacement for traditional ABA programs. That is the gold standard. That's where kids should be. I'm just like, kids can't get there right now. So let's give parents something they can be doing in the meantime.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned like some of the strategies that you're doing, in your course. So walk us through some of those key strategies and exercises that you feature in that course.
Okay. So, for the people who are behavioral, I'm going to try to make my language a little bit more layman friendly if there are people who are not as behavioral listening.
Okay.
So, what we know is that things that reinforce us or those things that strengthen our behavior are individual for every person. And when things that reinforce us are developed over time based on our learning history, and it's done through pairing, right? So like, we're all born with primary reinforcers. Those are the things that we're born with that function as reinforcers for us. Food, right. Water, freedom from pain, freedom from excessive cold and heat. But everything else in our world that reinforces us becomes reinforcer through this conditioning where it's paired with an already established reinforcer. So right. we know that we can create reinforcers from things that are neutral or have no reinforcing effect. So we also know that we spend a lot of time looking at things that reinforce us. So if we need kids to be spending more time looking at people so that they're available for the learning opportunities that are happening with people, then we need to work to make people function as reinforcers for our kids. And we can do this by doing pairing in play. So like one of the exercises that I have is called like an interrupted play chain. And essentially what you do, and it's unique for every kid, every parent needs to sort of tailor it to what works for their kid. They know their kids, what they think is fun. But when I was a therapist working one-on-one, one of the things that I like kind of always got a laugh from kids was I would creep like my fingers up their legs and I would sing a song. And then when I got up to the chin, I would tickle their chin and they would laugh. So what we're doing is we sort of build motivation for this terminal end fun point, right? Yeah. And we follow a similar pattern every time so that the kids come to expect when that fun point is happening. And then I work on teaching parents like just stop before the fun part, because then from a behavioral perspective, this very brief extinction period produces behavioral variability, right? So when you don't get an expected outcome, you try other things to see if you can get that outcome. And one of those things often is the kids just sort of looking around and eventually they look at your face. Mm-hmm. And that's when you're going to then proceed to the fun part. So we're essentially sort of pairing looking at the face with all these fun parts of the play chains. And so like I do a couple of demonstrations with my own kids and I model sort of what worked for my kids. You know, like every kid is totally unique and different. And so things that I tried out with my son, who is neurotypical, but they most kids all sort of respond the same way in these play chains. There were certain things that I thought for sure he was going to laugh at. And then like he didn't. And so I sort of abandoned it because I need to create something that's going to be unique for him. And that taps into his motivation. But like finding things that kids love, developing simple routines to it, and then inserting these pauses to start working on just building that, like looking and finding the face. And I intentionally don't call it eye contact because I really don't think that that's the most important piece to it. We yeah. have like the adult autistic perspective now that is like they're sharing. It's a little uncomfortable, makes me feel anxious. And I think a lot of parents are worried about the history of ABA with sort of forced eye contact.
Yeah.
And my goal is that we can accomplish both things at the same time, which is looking at people's faces is important because there's learning happening there, especially when we're talking about building language and like watching the mouth and seeing what the shapes are that the mouth makes in order to make sounds. And so that's important, but also maybe we can do it in a way that is a lot more respectful to the autistic experience. And so wanting to watch the face, yes, but also just changing the function of the value of the face so that it's not forced, it's not instruction, it's that we're now like it's a reinforcing place for our eyes to be. And so we're naturally just spending more time there so that we can then be available for learning and pick up on learning a bit more naturally.
Wow. I mean, just wow. I really, so first of all, few takeaways from that. First of all, I'm really happy that you talked about like the autistic person experience, you know, the history of ABA with forced eye contact is definitely something that is still prevalent in today's time. And so it's so nice to hear that in your course, you're not necessarily talking about full on eye contact, but you're looking for finding the face instead. So
exactly.
I really love that personally. Coming from a neurodivergent person, I love it.
Right, right. Yeah. And I have some adult friends that are on the spectrum. And I've been able to ask that question because, you know, when I first started Autism Jumpstart, you sort of have to build an online presence, right? Like social media is sort of a necessary beast of like growing and putting yourself out there. And boy, are there a lot of opinions on social media about ABA and autism and, you know, the history there. And so I really was very concerned and interested about the autistic perspective and wanting to make sure that it was respectful. It took that into account. And so I remember having a conversation with a friend of mine about this and, you know, he did ABA when he was a kid, he had early intervention when he was a child and he's a very successful adult. And he credits that early intervention to part of why he is so successful. And for him, he thinks, you know, he's like, we have to learn to make eye contact because like, that's what helps you be successful in a in our world socially, you know, that's the expectation from most people who aren't familiar with neurodiversity. So for him, I think he's sort of at a place where it doesn't bother him as much anymore, or that's at least what was his perspective. But there are a lot of people who don't feel that way. And so I want to be sure to take that into account in talking about how we are working with our very, very young kids, because, you know, obviously what's a big part of ABA is assent, right? Their willingness to participate. Sure, what I'm teaching parents is just how to play with their kids in a bit of a different way. But, you know, for our very young little ones who are 18 months old or 2 years old, they can't really tell us yet about their experience. And so my goal is to simply be able to educate and provide information to parents and then let them sort of take that information and use it in the most caring, compassionate, loving way with their own child.
I love it. I love it. And, you know, it makes me kind of curious to know too, you know, from a caregiver's perspective, have you ran into any caregivers who have had challenges just trying to get them, you know, to do the find the face or to do any of the strategies that you've talked about and that you're doing in your course?
Yeah, I think in the beginning, because of the way I explain it, I think that they think they're going to be able to start and it's going to happen immediately. And they don't understand that, like, it's going to take time. You know, behavior analysts know a lot about shaping, right? Which is just like, you don't expect the absolute perfect response the first time you do it. You expect some lower response and then you're going to gradually shape that over time. But that's really hard to teach. It's really hard to explain. And so what I end up doing is I do a lot of video consult with these parents where mm-hmm. they can sort of describe what they're going, like what their experience is. And then I can help give them a little bit more guidance on what I would do a bit differently. If it's not happening immediately, like let's take a couple steps back and start with something a lot easier for your kid. Let's start where they meet them, where they are essentially, because I'm just trying to educate parents. I don't really have any sort of like, it's not necessarily a curriculum where I can say like, here's where you start. I'm like, meet your kids where they are. If the first thing that I describe is something your child's already doing, great, move on to something else and then start where they are. Or if we need to take a couple steps back because they're not quite there yet, then let's do that. Like, at no point do we ever want an interaction with parent and child to be not fun and aversive, right? Like, we are trying to build reinforcing value here, so we do not want it to be aversive. And if your kids are showing you that it's not fun, then pull back. Like, we're not forcing through anything right now. Let's just find the places where our kids are laughing and then start there.
Yeah. You know, and it's great that you say meet them where they're at. You know, it's about progress, not perfection on the first try, right? Like,
absolutely.
We as behavior analysts are looking at shaping everything. And, you know, at the same time, like, I know it's so easy to say like, oh, I want my kid to do this right away. Like, this would be amazing. But, you know, it's a practice. It takes time. It takes work from everybody, right?
Right. And I think that we forget that perspective taking, like, as the person who's been doing this for 22 years, like, I of course don't expect perfection. But I think as a parent, when you're like, okay, I'm going to learn how to do this. And then the first time you sit down to play with your kid and it doesn't go exactly the way that it showed in the model, you're like, oh no, this isn't going to work. And so that's why I don't think there's any perfect way to do it. And so I really try to have a lot of interaction with the families that are going through the course, just to like be able to give them a little bit more unique tailored advice about their unique experience with their child.
Yeah. You know, and it's so good that you get to do that because you get to kind of like work with the family and kind of meet them on their level. Cause you know, when you think about it, what we do is we are an individual, we're individualized, you know. We don't want our goals to be cookie cutter straight out of just a random assessment just for the sake of it. You know, we're doing these on your goals, on your child's level, on what you need support with, you know? Yes.
And I would, you know, like in a perfect world, I wish I could have it be so much more individualized. But because it's just sort of broad learning for parents, it's hard to have it, but that's, you know, essentially every exercise is like, here's the framework. Now you take it and you individualize it to your child based on where they are and what their preferences are and what they like and what they like to do and what activities are fun for them. Because that's what I had to do when I was sort of doing the video models, is do the things that I knew were going to make my son laugh or my daughter laugh to show this is what we're looking for, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And to kind of jump from like the challenges, let's talk about the successes, you know, can you share any success stories or testimonials from your parents or caregivers who have used these techniques with their kids?
Yeah, I actually just got to do a video consult this morning, and the mom had her child there with her. And in the paperwork in the beginning where I sort of get, I ask for just like basic information about the kid just to get an idea about where they are developmentally, socially, communication wise. And in her questionnaire, she had said like, not really engaging in joint attention. And so for those who don't know, joint attention is like when we want to bring another person into an experience with us. Like if I see something that I think is really cool and I want somebody else to look at it too, I might look back at them and say, hey, caterpillar. And then I look back at the caterpillar after I've assured that that other person is now joined in this visual experience with me. And a lot of autistic children don't do this very naturally because there's a lot lower social motivation. So a lot of our kids like this caterpillar and they don't need you to also like it in order for it to be fun. Like you're not adding to the reinforcing effect of the caterpillar. So anyway, she had shared that her child was not really engaging in joint attention. And so we're doing our video call today and the child picks up a doll and walks over and looks at mom and says, doll. And I was just so blown away. I was so excited to see that some of these strategies are actually helping to, like, you know, do some of these very complex social behaviors that we're seeing emerge. You know, I do talk a little bit about joint attention in the course, but it's such a complex skill that it really does require, if you're going to work on it, requires like a BCBA really getting involved and observing and giving a very unique program for it. So I just talk about what it is, but I don't really go into it a whole lot. And so it wasn't like she had been working on that specific skill necessarily. It was just that she was working on holding on to reinforcers a little bit longer until her child found her face before giving it over. And so doing these, you know, the pairing of making the face a little bit more valuable, that we were starting to see emerge some of this really complex social behavior that shows inherent social motivation is increasing because there's a desire there. You know, she didn't have to be instructed to do it. She just brought the doll over and pointed to it and then looked at mom to make sure mom was also looking at the doll. So that was really cool.
That is incredible. Oh my God. That is the best. I always love hearing about just like the positive things that happen because far too much we get the negative. We get the, this happened, that happened, but you know, few and far between, like the positive testimonials. I mean, and that's amazing. Joint attention is such a complicated skill to work on in general. And yes, a complicated area to teach too, even, you know?
I think so too. I actually now wonder, like when we work on teaching it in a structured way, like in an ABA program, how much are we actually getting to the core of it, which is that kids are socially motivated to bring other people into their experience versus doing a bit of a rote programming where we're sort of teaching them what the expectation is of this exchange with another person. And I don't know if you can really tease it out, but I think you can tell the difference when you see a kid who is doing this, but doesn't necessarily look like they care about the other person. Like, hey, you know, they know what they're supposed to do, but they're not really interested in the other person in being involved versus watching it sort of happen naturally. And you're like, oh, that kid is really into that person. And like that, I don't know, that's such a light up for me because I'm like, yay, that's the core of it. We can get them socially motivated. Then they're going to start learning and they're going to start watching people and picking up on how to like pick up all these skills. So that's, I don't know. I'm just like, I'm such a nerd out about that.
I love that so much. Oh my goodness. Well, we're going to go ahead and introduce our first code word for the podcast. And it is the word GAP. That is G-A-P, GAP. So you mentioned social motivation. And one of the things that I get really curious about is how do we know when a child is truly socially motivated versus socially unmotivated? Tell me a little bit about your experience with that.
Okay. So when we would start out, I think when we think about like a traditional early intervention at an ABA agency, you know, you do an assessment and you identify skill deficits or areas where a child should be for their age chronologically and then where they are. And then, okay, now we're going to work to sort of teach them these skills.
Right.
At my agency that I was at, I started to shift this for when we were having new kids, because I really felt like people spend a lot of time early on doing very early learner programs, you know, like TACT or ECO, you know, and they don't spend a whole lot of time doing social reinforcer conditioning and making social stimuli function as reinforcers. One of the dependent variables, one of the things that I would have us take data on is just the rate of spontaneously looking up. And I would put a technician at a table with the child and I would just measure baseline. How often are they looking up at the person's face? Okay. And then we don't teach them to do it. Then we just start working on pairing and doing all of this play stuff where we're building in, you know, the play chains and the songs and getting them laughing and engaged and sort of like very child-centered, following them around and like participating and making solo independent play activities interactive. And then sort of do almost like an AB, right? So we would do a follow-up and just say like, okay, what's our rate per finding the face or looking up at the face now? And we would see an improvement. And I feel like that's really where we have to look for. I mean, that was a very, you know, when you're looking at data, you need some sort of concrete data to show that this is improving, but then you could see it naturally, right? Like people would say, oh, they're just naturally like, or they're walking through the grocery store and they're talking to people more often, or, you know, she wanted to come out and play with me instead of play by herself in her room. Like those are the social validity pieces that we get from parents, mm-hmm. In terms of whether or not the social motivation is improving. But I just think that that's really the core, you know, I don't know that we have research and data there yet, but my hypothesis is we do know that autistic children that are more social tend to have better long-term outcomes, but nobody can really point to why. And I don't think it's because they just are better socially. I think it's because the social motivation is higher. Yeah. And they're learning more. You know, like I've worked with kids who had very, very low social motivation, and there's just almost zero spontaneous looking up and looking at people. And when you are playing on your own for so long, you're not going to be learning through this more natural learning paradigm that most kids are learning from, which is just observing and participating in their social environment. And so I think that if we as practitioners can start really young by shifting our focus to doing a lot of social reinforcer conditioning, that we end up getting a lot more learning that happens naturally over time, as opposed to like when you think about an ABA program that has to teach every single skill in a repertoire. You know, hundreds of trials to teach these skills versus kids who are just paying a lot more attention to people and are picking up on learning a little bit more naturally.
Wow. That is so amazing to me because, you know, I think a lot about pairing, and when I think of pairing, I'm thinking like, oh, how many times are they going to approach you? How many times are they going to like initiate an interaction with you? How many times are they going to like smile at you? You know, different things like that. And I think that, you know, when I think about social motivation and pairing, you know, it's almost like the gaps there have to be bridged, you know?
Totally. Yeah. I think that it attacks learning from two different angles, from like an antecedent place and from a consequence place. Because when we think about just what childhood learning is, you're looking and you're watching, right? You're the opportunities for learning are there because you are attending, but then you're also sensitive to social consequences as reinforcers. And so when you have a parent who is delivering these social consequences, good job. Wow. I love it. All of these looking at smile. These are all conditioned social reinforcers. And so you have learning available and then you're sensitive to reinforcement. So you have obviously learning happens. And then when you think about a young autistic child who may not be watching people enough, they're missing out on the learning, right? But let's say they do catch a learning opportunity and then somebody delivers a social consequence that does not function as reinforcement for that child. Now that is not actually a learning opportunity because it hasn't been reinforced. And so I like in my course, I'm really going into both of these very heavily because I think if we can solidify these two things, get kids available for learning, and see the learning opportunities that are happening, and then make sure that these social consequences function as reinforcement. Because like we can use tangible reinforcers, right? But what's happening in the natural environment, what's happening in classrooms, what's happening when you go out in the community are that people are delivering social consequences. And you know, most people don't know what reinforcement is, But they just know, like, oh, thumbs up, good job. We've been conditioned to do these things. So if those can serve as reinforcement for our kids, like, learning is happening naturally.
And it's so great that you mentioned, you know, in the natural environment, that is what happens. You know, I'm not always going to give you the iPad because you said hi to me. You know, like, I'm going to say hi right back to you. I'm going to smile. I'm going to wave. I'm going to give that social reinforcer.
Yes. And, like, you know, and you're somebody who knows a lot about reinforcement and working with children. Like, think about people who don't have that history and experience. They're just, you know, like, when I go into classrooms and I'm watching teachers, they're all it is social consequences. Great job. I love that answer. Keep up the good work. Thumbs up. Hi, you know. And so if we want our kids to be successful in these environments, we need to make sure that the consequences that are being delivered in those environments are going to serve to reinforce. If we hope that they're going to be successful there without needing to have an RBT next to them, giving them a token every time, you know.
Yeah, because that's not what real life is about. Real life is social consequences, social reinforcers, everything in that, right? Everything there, you know?
Right. And I hadn't really thought about it until I was starting to, like, dive into the research on this. You know, I remember when I first started out working at an agency, I had this really great behavior analyst, a PhD, who worked there. And he was just like, you know, we have to do, he called it sensitivity to social praise. Because our kids are not sensitive to social, meaning that the social praise doesn't function as reinforcement.
Yeah.
But he didn't really explain why. And I actually don't even know if I've read anything specifically on this, but I was just sort of thinking about the reinforcer conditioning process. How, like, from infancy, right, you have a baby who's in their mother's arms nursing, let's say. And so your primary reinforcer, access to food, and then everything else that's being paired with that is starting to acquire reinforcing qualities because it's being paired. So looking at mom's face or hearing mom's voice or whatever is starting to acquire the reinforcing qualities. But we know also that infants, autistic infants from infancy, are not looking at people as often. So when they're accessing a primary reinforcer, maybe eating, they might not be looking at mom's face. They might be looking at the leaves blowing on the tree out the window. So this is what's getting the benefit of this pairing procedure. And this is why I think social consequences are not as strong as reinforcers, and that not every kid, right? But for a lot of autistic children, these social consequences just didn't get the same opportunities for pairing that where they were focused, where their eyes were focused, what they were looking at is what gained the benefit of these reinforcer conditioning moments, you know?
Yeah. I'm even thinking about just these past couple of weeks where I've done a lot more supervision for some of my techs, and it's like, you know, they're working on trying to get their clients to follow through with certain demands in place, which, you know, that's what they're supposed to do naturally. But at the same time, it's like, you know, have you even caught their attention? Have you even caught their motivation? Have you truly gotten that buy-in from the client?
Totally. I have started following and reading a lot of Greg Hanley's work. And then I went to a conference last weekend where Jonathan Tarbox gave a presentation about compassionate ABA. And I am like, I am hook, line, and sinker on this topic of really doing the work. It's harder for us. I get it. As practitioners, it's way harder for us. I would love to be able to give an M&M. Like, it's easy. That's a guaranteed reinforcer. We got that. But, like, that's not real life. And I feel like we're disservicing our kids by not doing the work of establishing that relationship, getting their buy-in, you know, setting them up for success in a way that, like, we understand where their motivation is and we're going to tap into that. And it's just hard. It's hard to do, and it's hard to teach our technicians to do that. So, like, I get the uphill battle, but I really feel like that's where ABA is heading, I'm hoping. And it's just a slow grind. It's a slow grind evolution.
Yes. My fingers are crossed. For sure.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you mentioned compassion, because one of the things that I'm thinking about, you know, with relation to the course that you are, that you have on your website, is about, you know, parents who have just received a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. Tell me what advice or guidance you offer to help them navigate through the journey effectively. And also too, especially in terms of implementing your course's strategies.
That's such a big, heavy question. I don't know that I cover all of the things that I think parents, like there's so many different gaps, and that's sort of, you know, where I hope to fill. I don't know that I can fill it all, but right. There's a gal that I met just through social media who's sort of doing the other end of it, which is like, hi, you just got a diagnosis. I'm here to hold your hand because this process can be bumpy. And I'm not as much in on that because I just don't know the logistical side of it. You know, I had a parent that I was working with, and they asked me a question about IHSS and do you know what the process is for that? And I was like, quite frankly, that's just out of my wheelhouse. Those are the logistic processes that I'm not a part of. So I think that there's room in this area for parents, for multiple professionals to sort of help fill the gaps. What I try to do is assure parents that they have the power to take control of their child's trajectory. Because I think that there is a feeling of helplessness of, I just got this information about my child and I am now being told I can't do anything about it. I'm waiting for other people to have openings and availability to be able to help me help my child. And so my goal is to try to just empower them with you don't have to have a master's degree to learn how to play. I call it productive play. Like, we're turning all of this normal, like you play with your kid every day anyway. Let's learn how to make it productive. Yeah. And it doesn't require a master's degree or a 40-hour RBT training or, you know, like, I don't want to discount how important RBTs and BCBAs are. And I don't want to discount how important ABA is. Again, I'm not trying to replace that. I had a conversation with another behavior analyst that didn't like the idea of caregiver sort of led because it may diminish our role. Like it makes it seem as if we're not important if we can just be teaching parents how to do this. And I'm like, there's a happy medium. I don't want to teach parents how to be a BCBA or an RBT. Yeah. But I also feel like teaching parents how to do something with their child and turn and create learning opportunities in their everyday interactions is so much more important than my reputation as a BCBA. Like I want to be able to help every kid and I can't. And so I want to like help empower parents to help their kids, you know?
And I think parent empowerment is huge. You know, it's a lot bigger than we think, right? Because, you know, they're coming into our services with their child that really needs our services. And the thing is, like, we are not, I feel like I have to emphasize this. We are not miracle workers, you know?
Totally.
Our services alone do not, like, they're not 100%, you know? Like, yes. There is going to be, ooh, hello. There's going to be some gaps along the way. Like, thank goodness no one can see this because I'm clapping around, you know, no big deal. I talk with my hands, just so you know, guys.
Totally, yes.
But anyway, you know, I actually, and it's so interesting you said that the caregiver led, like, that person didn't like it because it diminishes our role. But I think actually, you know, I worked in a setting where I actually had the parent, you know, do the goals with the client and also taught them strategies on how to work on, you know, for example, I think we were working on decreasing elopement. Mm-hmm. We were also working on just like attending to different tasks. We were also working on engagement and motivation and pairing and all of that too. You know, when we think about it outside of our walls, our families are with our kids 24/7.
Right. And if you think about, I don't know for you, if this is the truth for you, but this is definitely the truth for me. Mm-hmm. Every single incredibly successful program I supervised had such amazing parent buy-in on the program. The ones that I feel like were held back were the parents that were a little bit checked out. And I was in a non-judgmental way at all, because I get it, how overwhelming it can be as a parent. But I think when we can, those parents may not feel like they can add anything. And so I think every ABA agency who has a wait list would want to like refer their parents to do my course, because don't you want to bring in a family who the parents already feel like they are an involved member of their kid's team? They know they've seen firsthand the change that can happen for their child. And so like they're buying in, they're wanting to be an integral part of their kid's team. Because I think that makes for the most successful ABA program.
That's amazing. See, that's so amazing to me. And it's so, and I believe it's true too. I've been a BCBA for, it'll be my 8th year this year. Wow. It's crazy. and thinking about every family that I have worked with, it has been the parents that have had the families that have had the most caregiver involvement, that outcomes have been much better for, you know, yes. at least my history.
Right? Like, we know that like consistency is hugely important. We know that generalization and maintenance are hugely important, and we cannot be there every moment that the child is awake. And who is going to be there? Those parents. And so the ones that, you know, I think sometimes as a BCBA, just thinking about different motivational control, it can be a little easier to have a parent who's not as involved, who may not have as many opinions and pushing an agenda. So sometimes it's easier to run those programs, but I also think that those are the parents that aren't necessarily carrying over. The parents that are not as involved are not the ones that are carrying over when we're not there. And yeah. So we don't see as much progress anyway. So I don't know. It's a struggle managing these programs. And I just hope that like parents can understand that they are such an important piece of their program. And the more that they know, the more that they learn, the more that they come into the program already having established, like how much easier BCBA's job is going to be.
It's amazing. And it's so true. It is so true. You know, we, at the end of the day, like we want to help our families, help our client. Cause you know, this is a saying that I say a lot, but it takes a village to raise a child, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Our services alone do not do it all. You know, it's everyone.
Yep. Including the other prayer professionals who, like, that's another piece. This is completely unrelated to my my course, but I've been working a lot with other BCBAs, and one of them is an SLP also. And like her whole thing is on collaboration with other providers, how we should all be holding hands and coming together to care and support for our child, the occupational therapist, the speech pathologist, the physical therapist, like everybody. I think sometimes we all sort of get in our own boxes and are like afraid that we're going to either have our toes stepped on or we're going to step on toes. And it's like, again, when we think about the most successful programs in our history, they're the families that buy in, they're the team that works collaboratively together and cooperates together. And all is there supporting, and like, I know what they're doing and they know what I'm doing, because we want to be doing the same thing. We want to not work against each other and be teaching the, you know, opposite thing at the same time. So yeah, it takes a village, not just us and the family, but also all of the other care providers.
Agreed. I mean, coordination of care goes such a long way. I'm lucky to work with an SLP at my current job that has helped me so much, just with like basic communication strategies for a couple clients with speech generated devices. I'm lucky to have that as a resource, you know? So yes. To me, I just feel like that coordination with other providers, even people who work in the same company that happen to have other scopes that they mm-hmm. are worked under, it's such a nice and collaborative effort. And so, you know, I cannot encourage enough that collaboration, that coordination.
Yeah, it's humble ourselves. Maybe we don't know everything. Maybe we need to ask some questions.
True, very true.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Well, here we're going to do the second code word. Second code word we've talked a lot about today, and that is pairing. That is P-A-I-R-I-N-G. That is pairing. So tell me, you know, just some final advice, you know, for caregivers and parents who may be hesitant or unsure about enrolling in your course. What would you say to reassure them about the effectiveness and the accessibility of the strategies that you offer?
I think that there's no downfall. And maybe that's just because I put it together. But when I think about how young children are when they start showing signs, how so many parents that I have seen and worked with talk about being concerned at a very young age. I think also there's a lot of people that are like, if they don't have a diagnosis yet, then maybe you're pushing therapy too soon and it could be traumatic. And so I need to take a step back and say, this isn't therapy. It's teaching parents how they can engage with their kids in ways that bring focus and attention on the things that are important to stimulate learning and connection and communication. And so like when I think about the way that I teach parents to work on language development all through a verbal behavior lens. It's the same stuff I did with my kids who are neurotypical. So there's no like, oh, we're going to harm our kids if we get started before they ever have a diagnosis or before, you know, I feel like let's take advantage as much as we can of the brain plasticity at the younger ages. The moment that we realize that there is a delay, the moment that we're concerned about development, there's no downfall. It's literally just learning how to play and engage in different ways with our kids. And, you know, like I have a big long video of me sitting at my, at the table with my son when he was like just learning how to talk. And so it's the same stuff that I was just doing with him in like constant pairing, right? Like saying the words all of the time and contriving motivation and providing a coex, giving the model of the word and how we would say it, how I break it down and do some just like single syllable sounds so that he could get the starting sound for it, shaping language, how I would reinforce a lower approximation, you know, like, I think that, so I don't think that there's any downfall to it. And I think that I think that one of the biggest hurdles is parents just A, maybe not understanding development. So they don't really understand, but then also assuming that other professionals have their, but like this is not a dig at all on pediatricians. I've done a lot of videos on this. I don't know why they still wait so long for referrals. I understand that a formal diagnosis can't happen until a certain age. Like our diagnostic tools aren't developed for kids under a certain age. But I just like knowing what we know about how long everything takes, I'm still flabbergasted that they don't refer until 18 months, because that's when you make your phone call to be like, hi, I need my child to have an assessment. And they're like, great. 6 months from now, we'll be able to see them in our office. And it's like, why wouldn't we have referred 6 months earlier so that you could actually like get in the door for the office visit the moment that your child is 18 months. And so I just like, I'm hoping to be able to like enlighten parents and just open their eyes a little bit to like the possibility of what they can do for their kids. And I really don't see, I think that everything is just very easy and user-friendly, and it's, I don't know, that's my opinion, but that's also been the feedback that I've gotten too, is that it takes practice. Because you're sort of unlearning the way that you were playing with your kid before. So, you know, in one regard, it can be a little frustrating for a parent who's like, this is our natural instinct is to play in this way. And now I'm saying, instead of doing it that way, do it this way. But I really feel like, you know, nobody is too far gone to learn new ways to engage with their kid. So I really feel like every parent could benefit if their child is already, you know, showing signs, is just getting that diagnosis or going through that process and hasn't yet gotten off of a wait list. Like this is the prime time to start doing some of this really significant work with our kids. And I think every parent can learn how to do it.
That is amazing. Oh my goodness. Well, Carrie, it has been a joy talking to you all about this. I am super excited for this episode to launch, and tell our listeners where they can find you.
Yes, I'm Autism Jumpstart. The website is autismjumpstart.com, but I'm on Instagram and TikTok and Facebook. I'm all over the place. I also have a YouTube channel where I do longer videos because, you know, on social media, you have to do little short clips. So I have longer kind of like tutorial videos for parents understanding IEPs and understanding the basics of language or behavioral functions. And then some of them I actually are like very long, and they're CEUs for other BCBAs too. So you can watch it for free on YouTube, and then you can come to the website if you wanted to get a CEU for it. But that's where I'm at, and that's where you can find me. Awesome. And thank you. I love this. I don't know if you can tell, but I'm so passionate about talking. I could talk all day. So I just have like super enjoyed getting to share with you and engage with you. And thank you for having me.
Of course. And thank you for joining us. I'm super excited that you came on today. We talked a lot about just some really awesome stuff. So I'm really excited that our listeners are going to be able to listen to this. And on that note, I've been your host, Michelle Zeman, and I hope everyone has a good rest of their day. And be sure to tune into our next episode. Bye, guys.